Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Corey Stamper. She is a lexicographer who has written dictionaries for nearly 30 years at Merriam-Webster, Cambridge Dictionaries, and Dictionary.com. And tonight we're talking about her latest book, True Color, The Strange and Spectacular Quest to Define Color, From Azure to Zinc Pink. Corey, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thanks, Mark. It's great to be here.
I have to say, this is going to be one of my favorite books of the year. I can tell already. But it's also a wildly crazy book.
Yeah.
And from the very get-go, the quote from Myrna Loy as Muriel Blandings, boy, does that really sum up the spirit of this book.
It's true. Can I read that quote for?
Yes, you can. I love it. I've always loved that movie. Go for it.
So this is from the 1948 movie, Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House. And this is Myrna Loy as Mrs. Blandings talking to her workers. The living room. I want it to be a soft green. Not as blue-green as a robin's egg, but not as yellow-green as daffodil buds. Now, the only sample I could get is a little too yellow, but don't let whoever does it go to the other extreme and get it too blue. It should just be a sort of grayish yellow-green.
Now, you have to now read the definition of Scotch gray that's underneath that. Now, this is an actual dictionary definition.
This is a dictionary definition from Webster's Third New International Dictionary, which is an unabridged dictionary published in 1961. It is Scotch gray, noun, often cap S, a grayish yellow green that is yellower and paler than average sage green or palmetto and greener and duller than mermaid.
Well, that's clear. I can picture it right in my mind right now.
Right.
This is a book. This is a book that is all about this, as well as many other things. And it's a deep dive into the attempt to define color for a dictionary, which everybody might think, well, you know, it's no problem. Really think about it, and this book will make you think about it, and it's like nailing Jell-O to a wall. It's incredibly difficult. How did this love affair, your words, with color begin?
It really began with words, weirdly enough, not with color itself. So I was an editor at Merriam-Webster for 20 years, and one of my jobs was to proofread the transition of Webster's Third New International, that dictionary, who's one of the definitions I just quoted from, to the web. And in doing that, you basically have to read through the whole dictionary. And I'm very familiar with the style of the third. It's the book that sort of all Merriam-Webster editors are trained in. And it's very dry. It's very clinical. And these color definitions that I ran into just had so much personality and were so serpentine and kind of crazy. And I thought, these are not written in the style that was prescribed for the third. So someone made a decision to write them like this. And why would they do that? And that's really, you know, that was the trip into the rabbit hole.
And you really did.
You know, it took a
while. You went all the way down to Wonderland. You definitely did.
I did.
It started with the definition for begonia, the color.
Yeah.
And then you were completely undone by sea pink, which,
yes.
Which when you think about it, how does that even make sense as a name for a color? Because as you write, and as I thought, when you think of the sea, you think of sort of different, you know, aqua colors or green blues. Yet there's a pink in there.
Right. And why sea pink? And this is the other thing about these color definitions was they're using names for colors that I read a lot as an editor, and I'd never heard of these colors. I didn't know what icy pink was. I assumed it was a pink, but what made it oceanic? You know, it just did my head in, and I had to figure it out.
Well,
and that's where this book started.
The other thing is the color is so basic to our experience that we all assume, and I thought that as I read your book, that we could easily define what color is. I mean, I just never gave it that much thought. I will admit that I come across these color names and they make no sense to me whatsoever. And we don't know what colors are. And, you know, nothing could be further from the truth that we are very clear on how to find both the experience of color and the naming of color, what colors are.
Right.
And I think you describe it as maddening and beguiling.
Yes.
and it gets to us some very basic questions about how the human mind works, too, because I know what I think of when I think of the word aqua. How can I be sure that that's what you have in mind without a solid dictionary definition?
Right. And, you know, a lot of people now will just say, well, use color chips. But you really kind of point at something, Mark, which is, all of our perceptions are individualized. So what I see in that color chip that is labeled aqua, I might see it as slightly bluer than you do, because maybe I have more blue cones in my retina.
That's right.
Than you do.
That's right.
Or maybe I see it as greener because I'm older and my cornea has yellowed. So I see, you know, we're all, and that's the thing that's so crazy about this is, every experience we have of color is individualized. It happens deep inside our brain, so it's not something that we can show people. And yet, we have enough common experience of color that we can look at something and go, oh, that is aqua, and that other color is green, and that other color is blue, even if the edges between green and blue and aqua are fuzzy.
And there's also, and you write about this, weird claims about color historically. And my favorite is that the Greeks couldn't see blue.
Right.
So why did people believe that?
Our experience of color is so tied to the language that we give color that in foreign languages and other languages, if they don't have a color term that matches up one-to-one with the color term in our language, it's very easy to assume the reason they don't have that is because they can't see that color. Color's so foundational.
Yeah.
It is one of the first sets of words that we all learn. So the Greeks, the ancient Greeks, as the claim goes, don't have a word that means blue. And so the idea that people sort of glommed onto was like, well, the ancient Greeks can't see blue. And they point to Homer, who in both the Iliad and the Odyssey called the sea wine dark.
Right.
They're like,
right.
See? If it was blue, Homer would say it's blue. Well, a couple of things. Homer was a poet, so he did a whole lot of things with language that unexpected. But the other thing is the ancient Greeks actually have two core color words for blue, and one of them is a color word that we get our word cyan from. They could see blue, but because we don't have a one-to-one correspondence, we don't have, this is the Greek word that means blue as English speakers understand blue, then we jumped all sorts of weird conclusions about the ancient Greeks' ability to see color.
Well, that idea that people keep trying to come up with color theories. Excuse me. Berlin and Kay's theory of color name evolution and the Himba people of the Namibia. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So in 1969, there was this foundational study done by an anthropologist and a linguist called Basic Color Terms. And the two scholars, Berlin and Kay, basically claimed, after doing a broad survey of world languages, that languages adopt or create color terms in the same order. And they use some kind of unfortunate language about evolution of language and evolution of society. But their idea is that there are these seven steps that every language follows. And as your language develops and adds more color terms, basic color terms, they follow this particular step. Now, one of the early steps, I think it's step four, is weird, because what happens is we start with black and white, then we get red, and then we get blue or green, and then we get the next color, either blue or green. And the thing is that people say, well, how do you know which blue and which green? And there's a tribe in Namibia named the Himba. And the Himba have this really fascinating way of carving up color. They do it mostly by light and dark, not necessarily by hue. And the Himba are one of these languages that gets studied a lot because their language has two words, Dumbu and Buru. And Dumbu is for some greens and some blues, and Buru is for other greens and some other blues.
By the way, there's a great illustration in this book. People should read.
And the thing is those greens and blues that are in Dumbu, for instance, English speakers put those in two different color categories. We would call the greens green. We would call the blues blue. But the Himba call them all Dumbu or Buru. And so one of the experiments that has been done on the Himba is to see how quickly can they distinguish between a blue Dumbu and a green Dumbu. And it does take them a little bit of time because they call it by the same name. Just as we call two nearly identical greens green,
right,
but they might be Dumbu and Buru to the Himba, so they can see the difference really quickly.
Well, I want to talk about a lot of other things before we... But the point of that is everybody was like, oh, wow, finally we're starting to understand some of the deep down, you know, aspects of color perception. But it's all been disproved, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting because some of the things that we have about, some of the things we think we know about color perception are wrong. Some of the things that we think we know about human biology are kind of a question mark. We still aren't entirely sure how the eye and the stimulus that we receive through the eye gets translated to a color in our brains. But the thing is because color, like language, is so foundational to our experience, yeah, it's really difficult to sort of uproot common misunderstandings about color. This is a thing that scientists have been, you know, kvetching about for hundreds of years. You know, well, people need to stop saying that the objects have color, for instance.
The great thing about this book is that, yes, it's a big rabbit hole that's wild, but then there are sub-rabbit holes that are just as crazy. One of them is about the production of colorant dyes and the world wars. Mm. And I can't even get into that because that's like three other conversations. But there is actually a thing called a dye famine that occurs. And out of that is the development of color meters. But I think the thing that really struck me as insane is butter and oleomargarine.
Yeah. So yeah,
talk about that, because if we start to go about the dictionary stuff, really, we'll be here for years. We can't. By the way, I want to say there were sections of that when I almost threw the book against the wall, going, "These people are idiots." And it was hilarious. I mean, I was laughing out loud.
Wrong.
I know. And I also, at the same time I was saying that, I felt deep pity for the people who had to be in the middle of this. But anyways, let's talk about oleomargarine and butter color.
Oleomargarine, or margarine, was developed in the 1800s. because there was a need for a shelf-stable version of butter. And, you know, butter being made from cream could go rancid. It didn't travel well, melted. And so margarine was created. Now, margarine is white. It is a product that is naturally white. But no one's going to spread this weird white paste on their toast. So margarine manufacturers began to dye it yellow to match butter.
Mm.
And this caused a huge uproar in Congress. There was a series of hearings called the butter hearings. And the idea was, this was also a time, early 20th century, when in America, the government was really focusing on food adulteration.
Right,
so,
right.
You know, people would sell milk that they said was, you know, healthy, full, you know, full-fat milk that was actually water and chalk, or things like that. So the government really wanted to make sure that when people bought a food item that was mass-produced, they knew what was in it. And this was the pretense for bringing margarine to trial. There was a series of congressional hearings in which a whole bunch of experts were called to, you know, testify to the purity of margarine. But one of the huge issues that was centered on was that margarine was being sold dyed yellow.
Hmm.
And there was one senator from New Hampshire, dairy state,
oh, God.
Who was adamant. He said, yellow is the color of butter and butter is yellow, period. And he said, you know, look, margarine can have any other color. We can dye it whatever color people want, but it can't be yellow because butter is yellow. Because people, when they buy a spreadable substance for their toast that's yellow, assume it's butter.
Didn't he actually suggest, like, they could do dye it blue or
yeah.
green?
Yeah, black was the favorite one. We're going to dye it black. And one of the experts who was, you know, a public health guy from Columbia University was like, yeah, people aren't going to spread black stuff on their toast. But, you know, the point was we have to make sure that people understand that margarine is not butter.
Right.
And butter is so associated with the color yellow that we can't have margarine be yellow. And this led to the passage of what's called the Oleomargarine Act, which allowed states to regulate what color margarine was dyed in their state. So it created this very weird black market for yellow margarine.
Wow.
Some states
a black market, wink, wink.
Yeah, wink, wink, yeah, a yellow market. Some states dyed margarine pink. Some states demanded that it be sold undyed. Margarine manufacturers got around that by selling it undyed with a packet of yellow dye.
I love that.
Because the point is, people want a butter substitute. It needs to look like butter.
But this brings, this brings up an important point, which just adds to the whole complexity of the process here, is that the public, and this is a quote from your book, I think, has an inherent sense of what color should be.
Yes.
That's a problem.
Right. Yeah, it is. It is.
Because when you're putting a dictionary together, you're okay. trying to serve the public.
Right.
Yet in this history of Merriam-Webster, I think it was two, right? That they are one of the things the dictionaries did is they would bring in experts, say from different sciences, to help write up the citations for the different topics. And so when the people were dealing with it, they were bringing in these scientists who had no concern for the public whatsoever.
Right, yeah. No, the unwashed masses were to be educated, not pandered to, certainly, yeah.
And there are some people in that process. Paul Carhart. There's a lot. I mean, there's a lot of people. Dr. Goodlove, first of all, that sounds made up.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, can you give a short, just the Carhart-Goodlove problem?
Yeah. So Paul Carhart was a managing editor at Merriam-Webster. He was actually a pronunciation guy, but he was, you know, affable and friendly, and so they gave him a whole bunch of stuff to do. And one of the things that he did for the second New International Dictionary was he oversaw all of these scientists that you were talking about that got hired to write definitions in their field. And up until the second, color was not considered a specialty field. Color was kind of a like, well, there's art colors, and then there's important colors in history, mm-hmm. like kermes, and that's kind of it. Like, it's not anything special. But because of the way that color science had been propelled forward during World War I, color was now a hard science. There was a lot of measurement and specification and standardization that happened. And so Carhart kind of cast around for a color scientist and got a false start with one scientist, but eventually ended up with I.H. Godlove, who was a scientist who had worked at a color standards company. He had a whole lot of contact across government standardization groups and across all these different industries. And he was kind of this weird Renaissance man. I mean, he was weird, period. Anyone who deals with dictionaries is weird, full stop. But he was really this interesting Renaissance man because he was a very well-regarded scientist. But he also was just so fascinated with color as a topic in our culture.
Yeah.
So he was kind of a great person to attempt to bridge the gap between the scientist and the layperson. So Godlove was super excited. He was going to help out writing these dictionary definitions. And he had some good lexicography instincts, but there was just constant headbutting between Carhart and Godlove.
That was being generous.
I'm trying to keep it PG here for the radio audience.
Well, I mean, there were so many issues. And one of the issues is a lexicographer like Carhart, he's working on deadlines. I mean, you're trying to publish something. Deadlines are looming all the time.
And it's
like the people on the science side just did not get deadlines or something.
Yeah. Well, you know, for Godlove and the scientist that he had sort of inherited this job from, who was even screwier and very much did not think anything of the public's ability to grasp anything about color. You know, for Godlove, his whole thing was, look, color science is constantly changing. Science is on the move.
Right.
And if you want this to be as scientifically accurate as you're telling me you want it to be, then you have to let us determine certain things that really make no sense to the layperson, but are foundational for the color scientist. Like, what's the difference between light and bright?
Right.
Which you wouldn't think would be, you know, kind of like, whatever, one's light, one's bright. But this was so much ink was spilled in the color science world the difference between bright and light. So Godlove's kind of like, look, I can do what I can do, but really, you know, if you want this to be scientifically accurate, then it's going to take me a little bit, and these definitions are going to be really long. The definition for color in Webster's Second New International Dictionary is one full dictionary page.
Wow.
It is, you know, about 3,000 words.
Well,
it's not a definition. It's a mini history lesson and color science lesson.
Well, this is, and we're almost out of time, so I can't get into this. People have got to read the book. Trust me. But they also, the scientists started making demands, like how many color plates there were going to be in the dictionary, not understanding that how expensive the color plates are. At that time, you could only print one to a page. You couldn't do the reverse because the colors would bleed through. It was a and they didn't get stuff like, it's expensive. It was like,
Right. Well, especially because they're like, well, you know, look, it's a standard. And if you want us to print this to the color tolerances of a standard, then surely you are fine with the expenses. But on the other side, Carhartt is like, it's a commercial product. We cannot sell a dictionary for $900 because you want seven color plates that are printed to scientific tolerance.
Oh, my God. And by the way, we're just doing the surface. It gets deep and weird. And we're almost at, we're virtually out of time, but I want to say I love the I love you at the Inter-Society Color Council event with you with your tote bags. Trust me, this is an amazing book. My guest tonight is Corey Stamper. She is a lexicographer who has written dictionaries for nearly 30 years at Merriam-Webster, Cambridge Dictionaries, and Dictionary.com. And we've been talking about her latest book, True Color, The Strange and Spectacular Quest to Define Color from Azure to Zinc Pink. Corey, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much.
And I love the fact that you wrote this book. Thank you so much for that experience.
Thank you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.